Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, everyone. I'm Julie.
And welcome to A Good Story is Hard to Find,
where two Catholic friends talk about the popular books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that we see underneath.
Yes. And this is episode number 18.
Woo.
And today we're going to talk about Contact by, it's from a book written by Carl Sagan, but we're going to be talking about the movie starring Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey.
All right.
And it's directed by Robert Zemeckis. It's from 1997. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and describe it.
Sorry, yes. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Outer space and all that stuff.
Outer space. So what it is, it's a movie about a character named Ellie Arroway. It's really about her, but she... Her main job function is to participate in something called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, where she listens to the radio a whole lot, hoping to hear aliens talk to her, and they do, about halfway through. And from that point on, it's the story of, you know, there's some epicness involved, you know, trying to take wide view of how the world responds, as well as how it affects her life specifically. But I think that the movie is really about her, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so, her, not only her responses to alien contact, but everything she does is based on her childhood experiences, both of her own nature and of her experiences with her father.
Mm-hmm.
His encouragement and the lack of him.
Right, right.
Yeah. After a while.
Right. So I don't know how much more there is to say in summary. This is a novel written by Carl Sagan, like I mentioned before. And I read the novel back in high school. Let me see what
it was
written.
Yeah, I didn't realize he wrote novels.
He only wrote the one. That was
okay.
It. Yeah.
Just this one. Was he famous at the time, do you think?
Absolutely. I think the show Cosmos, the billions and billions of stars all over the galaxy, all that was in the 70s.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is something that he wrote kind of late in his life. He passed away. I did look that up. He passed away in 1996.
Okay.
And the movie was released in 1997. So...
But he was
I would
a producer.
Imagine that he would have something to do with it. Yeah. So
yeah.
I'm sure that the movie was complete by the end of 1996. So he had something to do with it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, I was talking about that with Rose yesterday, and we were thinking that maybe, you know, if the book got optioned and he'd have said, oh, hey, I want to have it happen, he would have put money into it and possibly some creative input. So
yeah,
that would be
surely.
The producer tag.
Right, right.
So...
Yeah, so the book is not a great novel. It's a first novel. It does me, you know, and I'm speaking largely from memory. I listened to a lot of the only audio version of this exists is abridged, and it's read by Jodie Foster, and it is really, really excellent. You know, normally you don't like, or I don't like abridgments, but in this case, it's probably not a bad thing. Because,
yeah.
You know, Carl Sagan goes off on all kinds of tangents and things. But there are numerous differences between the book and the movie, you know, like there often is. But there's one that I'll talk about specifically because it kind of really blew me away in the novel. But they didn't mention it in the movie. Probably because it would have been too complicated. I would have think, you know, they would have said, okay, now we need to explain this. The reason that I picked this movie is because it hit me at a really good time in my life when I was really searching hard, you know. So this is again 1997. This is right about when I started going to Catholic Church again. And the whole thing, you know, there's always been two halves of me fighting each other, and it wasn't until I really realized that, again, this is all one thing, that I was able to be comfortable and move forward in Catholicism. You know, now this book or this movie is, of course, not saying, hey, Catholicism is what you should be. In fact, the no, Catholics in here are not great examples. But what it does do is it takes the scientific part. And Carl Sagan, well, gosh, I have so much to say. it takes the scientific part and reconciles it a bit with the spiritual part, in my opinion, is what this movie does. And it does it through philosophy and the setting up of a situation in which a scientific person experiences, in a way, what a religious person experiences, and she has to try to explain it.
Yeah, and I think that might be common for scientists also to suddenly have that epiphany that they can't prove, and then they have to try to prove it. I mean, with other, you know, you read things about people who woke up from a dream of, you know, a serpent eating its tail or something and go, oh my gosh, that's how DNA works. But then they have to go make it happen. Those moments of insight and clarity.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff.
So you love the movie.
Yeah, well, I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. And it's not a perfect movie, as we'll get into. But we've talked a little bit before, and I have two things about the movie that I really disliked. And your list is longer.
Well, my family watched it. We really didn't like it at all. I mean, for the talking points and for the concepts to get to talk to, that's all fine. But wow, it was surprising to me how different our reactions were. We were among, and we went and looked up reviews going, what else has Robert Zemeckis directed? Because, and I'm like, oh, Romancing the Stone, Back to the Future, Castaway, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I wasn't crazy about Forrest Gump, but you know, he won an Oscar for that. And I'm like, I hated this movie. I hated it. And I'm sorry to, and I'm not trying, I'm not, this is just one of those things where two people who see most things eye to eye see them so differently that I don't think we can understand why, you know, each other embraces it or can't stand it. But I mean, we just, the acting, the script, the everything, but there were things I liked about it. But those were more separate things where I was like, oh, why couldn't there have been more of this in the movie? And I just thought it was kind of funny. It was almost, as my husband said, after you and I had talked a little bit, one of those classic Siskel and Ebert moments for anybody who'd watched them from a long time ago, where one person would go, well, this is the best movie ever. And the other one would look at that one in disgust and go, what movie were you watching? Yeah, because, wow, I just felt like Jodie Foster's, you know, one of the examples for me of how I looked at this was, I really don't like the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And I have been castigated by people for that far and wide because it's such a great movie. But for me, that movie showed Jimmy Stewart's acting liabilities so much. He was the same character he always was. And to me, he didn't fit in that Western. And I was like, wow, what a horrible casting call. And so one of the things for me in this was I looked at it and went, wow, Jodie Foster, she can only do like two things. And she's having to do them all through the movie. And Matthew McConaughey, I feel like, was a real mistake because it's like casting Owen Wilson. He's the only actor I could think of like him. Now, I know Woody Allen got a great performance out of him, I guess, in, oh, what's that movie? Midnight in Paris? Which I haven't seen. Yeah. But it's just, we just were like, you know, it was a not predictable script because I loved what they did with it in the end with the alien contact. But so much of, many of the lines were predictable and some of the crisis moments were predictable. And I don't know. I just, we clearly saw two different movies. And I don't know if it's just our mindset and the travel from 1997 to 2011 wasn't good for us, you know, or or what, but wow, I could never recommend it. Okay. Other than the idea of a lot of the concepts inside of it were good.
Right, right.
So I'm really sorry, Scott.
No need to be sorry. Jodie Foster was fine for me. I really liked her in this movie. Like I mentioned earlier to you, personally, I know people just like her, Ellie Arroway.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt what she did was great. There wasn't a single moment in the movie where I was concerned about what she was doing. But Matthew McConaughey, it wasn't even the acting that bothered me. His whole character bothered me. He's one of the things about the movie that I disliked.
Get done and say the same thing that you did, which was, why didn't they just make them good intellectual sparring buddies?
Yeah. And in the book, I should back up. Palmer Joss is the name of the character that Matthew McConaughey plays.
Yes.
And when they first meet, Ellie Arroway is in South America at the Arecibo Radio Observatory, and she's gone into town to pick up some stuff, and he's there, and he starts to talk to her, and it's later at a party that she discovers that he was a priest, because somebody called him Father Joss. Well, he was never actually a priest. He went through everything to become a priest, and then decided that sex was more important. So he didn't. What did he say? You could call me a man of the cloth without the cloth. And then I think the next scene they're in bed together or something. So
yeah,
me greatly. So what the purpose of Palmer Joss was in the movie is he was supposed to be this person that was so full of faith, and Ellie is the opposite. She doesn't have faith. Her faith is all in science. And they were able to talk to each other. And there was a lot of moments in which they used that effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole concept of the character was flawed, in my opinion. And after that eye-rolling moment, I was annoyed by him.
Well, yeah, because he's just kind of like a surfer dude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's okay. Surfer dudes can have faith and have tried the seminary and do all these things, but he never came across as anything more than... they would have those moments of conversation where I go, oh, good, they made that point and they let it sit.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't immediately smack
it
down.
That's something that I loved about the movie.
So I thought, did, to its credit, I thought that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
But, it could have been delivered more credibly. But they didn't treat faith. Well, we talked about this too. They didn't treat faith very well in the book anyway, because... when Ellie is young, I don't think this is a spoiler. Do you?
No, it's okay. We should jump into spoilers anyway. There's really nothing else to say in summary. everything else is spoiler. So go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Well, because when she it's made clear early on that she's very passionate about science and experimentation, and her father fosters this. And much later on, you discover her mother died in childbirth. But when you see her, she's young and alone with her father, who's encouraging her and all these things and helping her think outside the box a little bit on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he dies, and she couldn't get his heart medicine to him in time and blah, blah, blah. And then they show her sitting outside, and this older priest kind of awkwardly tries to comfort her. And actually what he said was not so bad. It was kind of like, well, this is awful. We don't know why it happened. We just have to try to trust that somewhere God's will is there for us or something. It wasn't even, it's God's will. So that was good. But then she looks up and she's 9 years old and she goes, if only his medicine had been downstairs, I could have gotten to it sooner and he wouldn't have died. It's my fault or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of goes, and runs away. I'm just going, he could have said one or two more things that would have stuck with her later instead of going, I was just schooled by a 9 year old and I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
Thank you for not representing anything that well at that point. But
gotcha. I thought that was a powerful moment. And it was a definition of Ellie's character.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So what she didn't even consider for a moment what he said. she was completely calculating. As in, you know, if that medicine had been downstairs, I would have been able to get it to him quickly and he wouldn't have died. It had nothing to do with God. It didn't even enter her mind.
Yeah, well, and it was all her failure. She was very, it was on her. She failed.
Yeah, I guess so. To me, I mean, she was completely sad, but I didn't get the impression that she felt that it was her failure that caused his death. I felt that she was saying it was just a calculation. This is just math. If I had had it downstairs, I'd have been quicker.
Well, maybe, but I also felt there was that component that made her really directed and passionate and everything later on. You know, the thing that had her out in the field sitting by her old car so she could, I don't know why she was sitting by the satellites. Mm-hmm. That was something else where, like, the headphones don't work inside the building, but okay.
I know that was kind of cool. I know people like that too.
Well, that's, you know, and we're like,
she's just I don't want to sit in here. I want to go out there. And she's the like, open the sky and all that stuff.
Well, that was the passionate part of her. I was going to allow that from the passion that she felt where she had to be next to the whatever out under the sky. But that was the thing where she wasn't necessarily beating herself up because they couldn't find a signal before funding got pulled. Mm-hmm. But she took everything so seriously that she gave all to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that was the thing with the medicine.
Yeah.
You know, and so I guess that's why I felt like that defined her as an adult in terms of it's all tangible and it's on her to prove it or not prove it.
Yeah.
And I never understood, this is a different point.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that when you're blind, you know, your other senses are enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
But I never understood how the blind guy could hear all these things that no one else could hear and the signals that no one else could find in the computers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was very helpful to her. You know, she didn't care that he found it. She was just excited. So
yeah.
I'm not saying she felt like she had to do everything herself.
Sure, sure.
I did enjoy all those, hey, it's that guy moments. There were a lot of big people in this.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, and that is another, actually, an aspect that I did not like about the movie. And I remember this being a controversy when it first came out, too, because they took, for example, Bill Clinton was president at this time.
Yeah.
And they took a speech that I believe, you know, I wish I had looked this up because
it was
at
about
the
Mars rover.
Oh, was it? I thought it was about Dolly the cloned.
No,
remember the cloning
thing?
Well,
the listening thing was about the Mars mission because we were going. Was that Bill Clinton for the movie, or did they just pull news clips? We were very confused about what was going on.
Is,
it really did yank
actual,
us out of what was happening.
Actual speeches, I think two of them. And they just spliced it into this movie to make it seem like he was talking about what was going on in the movie. And then they put the actors, you know, there was one scene where I remember you could see Clinton talking, and then in the background was Tom Skerritt and Jodie Foster.
Right.
And, you know, whenever I see that, I think, oh, they put these actors in this scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess
I never
that was
thought, oh, wow, how, you know, this is real. You know, it removed me from the story. It was distracting. It had nothing. It wasn't a good thing to do.
Well, and see, I didn't really, that's one of the things I didn't like about Forrest Gump. And clearly he was working up to that.
Oh, sure.
Robert
Zemeckis. You know, it didn't occur to me that he did Forrest Gump until you said it earlier.
Yeah, well, because I was like, well, I know he did Back to the Future. Why do I hate this? Why? What else has he done? I know he's done things I like. And I was like, oh, man, everything around it. But I think that was about the time he was really falling in love with the technological side. Because, you know, all the stuff he's done more lately, and Polar Express isn't late, but like his most recent movie is all motion capture. He did Beowulf. Or was it Beowulf and Grendel?
Yeah.
He did one of those movies where it was all about the CGI and the motion capture and everything. And it was like, but you're letting the story go.
Yeah.
My opinion.
I haven't seen.
Might have loved
one,
those.
So.
I don't know.
No, I haven't seen them.
I haven't seen them, but but I thought it was kind of an interesting transition looking at his list of movies. You've got Romancing the Stone, the three Back to the Futures, Who Framed Roger Rabbit starts that, but that was a great movie. And then I think then was this movie, Contact, and then Castaway, which, oh, amazing. I couldn't believe I did
it. I've seen that one. That doesn't ring a bell at all.
Castaway. Oh, you never saw Castaway?
Well, it doesn't ring a bell.
Tom Hanks, FedEx.
Oh, he was alone on an island
for 10 years.
Okay, yeah, I have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then after, I think it was after this that he did Forrest Gump. I don't have the order right, probably, but those were all clustered. It was a long string of hits. And but you could see the technological side is kind of always kind of interesting to him. Which is kind of beside the point. But it's kind of funny because we saw the same thing that you mentioned when you went looking for reviews yesterday with that Roger Ebert had said about the movie. He was like, he liked this movie because it was so much better in terms of conveying that sense of wonder and exploration. And he didn't say this, but I kind of took friendly aliens out of it as opposed to he directly compared it to Independence Day, which is, of course, a War of the Worlds scenario. And, you know, and I barely remember any of that because I, you know, it was just a big action movie. It didn't, you know, it had Will Smith. You just kind of go, oh, yeah. And the only reason I actually think of Independence Day is because I saw it after having seen Mars Attack about five times and was like, oh, I now see why everybody wonders if Mars Attack ripped off Independence Day. Because they're so parallel, but they came out at very similar times.
Yeah. So I need to watch that one again because I don't really remember it very well.
Yeah, that's another one that I can, you know, that's a gimme for most people. I'll say Mars. I love Mars Attack. Oh, my gosh. And they're like, really? What's wrong with you?
You bet.
So I love it.
Yeah. And yeah, this movie. Yeah. He negatively compared it or.
Yeah.
He wasn't favorable. Yeah, exactly. He was just saying, you know, yeah, Independence Day is what it is. And
was awful.
But this is a totally different thing. And that's one of the reasons that I love it is this is a more realistic look at how alien contact could possibly happen. You know, there's been a lot of people thinking about alien contact for, you know, obviously years and years and years and years. And, you know, there's a lot of paradoxes. There's a lot of really confusing things out there. You know, they, back when this movie came out, you know, we just figured that, hey, you know, there's got to be other planets out there, you know. But now we know for sure that there are. I looked it up this morning and there's 520 now that are outside of the solar system that we've now detected.
And some of them, I think they've even detected water on them? Or
well, there was a big story about 6 or 8 months ago about one that was right in the right zone.
And
they were very excited about it. In fact, one scientist said something like, oh, there's positively going to be life there.
well,
you know,
it's
tough. You know, I mean, we've only got one example. We've got the Earth. And there is life everywhere. I mean, you go down to the bottom of the ocean in a volcano, and there's, like, microbes down there. So that's our only example. So it's
well, I have two reactions to that because one is it's the only one that's in the right zone. It's because I read so much science fiction and I know you have more than me even, I think. And it's like, well, okay, you're being awfully limiting.
Yeah, and you
as
are
to what life is.
Yeah.
That you're saying this is the only one in the right zone.
Exactly. We've only got one example and that you need liquid water is a prerequisite for life of our type. And but that doesn't mean that that's all that there is. You know, we have no idea. You know, the one thing that I'm sure of is that if and when we get out there, it's not going to be like we think it is. Because if you imagine, you know, all of our experimentation and everything, we're looking at the universe through telescopes and making all these conclusions. And, you know, it's really kind of amazing to think that you know, trying to think of something to liken it to. We're looking across the ocean at Florida and trying to determine what's over there, you know.
I was just thinking, it's like those old maps, here be monsters or there be dragons or whatever, and they've got the sea serpents. And
Right.
But even that, they had some basis for reference. This is more like the, oh, don't get too close to the edge because you're going to go off.
And they're coming up with all kinds of ways to, you know, just the way, you know, I don't even know for sure that the way that they're detecting planets is going to be positive. I don't know how they're able to decide how big the planet is. I understand the concept. You know, they're looking at, you know, when a big planet goes on one side of a star, the star wobbles just a touch to the to that way. And then when it goes to the other side, it wobbles just a touch the other way. And then they can say, okay, so now there has to be this much mass. Okay. Yeah, there has to be this much mass pulling it that much. That's one method that they use.
They're so clever.
So they can tell that something is going around the star. That much I can totally agree with and all that. And then they must be doing some other mathematics to decide, you know, yeah, this one is actually going to be exactly this far away, and it's going to probably have water. You know, I don't know how they're doing that.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. I was like, how can they tell if it has water if they can hardly even see it? Or
the thing is, it all has to do with light. You know, if they're actually detecting oxygen, it's light. You know, if they can get light from a source, they can tell what elements are being reflected or excited in order to give off the light, which is amazing to think about. I mean, that's what all the SETI is. You know, the SETI is a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And when you think about that, I have an NPR story that I absolutely loved. It's called When Lucy Enlivens the Universe. And I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But what it's about, it's by Krulwich.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, me too. And he was talking to a scientist who was saying that all of this stuff that we put out into the atmosphere or the universe, you know, like our TV signals. And he was using I Love Lucy as an example. The problem is, no matter how, it's just a news story that's like 8 minutes long or something. Okay. But no matter how strong our signals are coming out of the planet, by the time it hits Pluto, it's part of the background of the universe. So you know, and then you get to hear just a little bit about, or you know, he what turns up the volume on what the background of the universe sounds like.
Oh,
and
great!
And you listen to that, and you're like, oh wow, you know what's in there.
Well,
at least that's what I think, you know, because it's very exciting to me. So, but he's also, it makes you think that, you know, one of the premises or one of the things that happens in this is that the first major television signal, the first big one, was actually the Olympics from Germany in, what was it, 1932?
1936. Because we got interested in that, so we looked it all up.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, they broadcast, and it's Hitler announcing the opening of the Olympic Games. And they receive this in Vega 26 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And Vega is a star that if you go outside at night, you can see almost straight over your head.
Okay.
At this exact time of year, it's bright white blue.
Okay.
It's almost straight over your head. And it's over my head, almost straight up,
enough.
But you're down. So it's going to be a little bit lower. Close enough. And, anyway, then they take it and they package it and they rebroadcast it back to the earth. And then, so 52 years later or so, we start to hear it.
Well, and that was, I have to say, that was one of the things I really did like, was that whole opening sequence, although they don't have that background noise that you're talking about, all the static. And
They don't. It turns into silence.
Because I love the story about the scientists who kept going, we keep getting these microwave sounds or whatever. And they finally figured out, oh, wait, these are echoes of the Big Bang that we're still hearing, you know.
Yeah.
So I know there's all that stuff out there. But I did love the opening sequence where they're pulling out from the earth and you're hearing all the current radio and TV. And then as you get further out past the planets, it's older and older and older stuff. And then you get way far out and there's just silence out there. And I was like, wow, that is really great.
Yeah,
making the point in a great way. And so then when you're prepped for when you get the Nazi, you know, Hitler opening the games back and you're just like, this was brilliant in so many ways because it says something that we have to overcome. It it panders to the people who go, oh, he was evil and they're sending something evil. And everybody has to go, they don't even know what it means. Mm-hmm. They just know it's a radio or a TV signal.
Yeah.
And the fact that of the science of it, how far out is it? How far back is it? And then we went and because that made us go look it up because mm-hmm. we're like, would people have even had TVs? And what they did is, which makes a lot of sense, they wanted to show how progressive Germany was. So they had set up all these viewing rooms in different cities around Germany.
Oh, wow.
And they broadcast it to them and you could go to a viewing room and see it on a TV there. I was like, oh, how clever of them. And that makes sense why it had to be strong or stronger than,
right.
You know, than usual. So,
yeah.
So that was very interesting to find out.
One of the interesting things to note as well is we are actually much more quiet now than we were back then.
Really?
The earth got really, really noisy, and now it's getting much quieter because all of our signals are directed. We're not like just broadcasting willy-nilly. And
cable.
Here, even in the little town that I'm in, you know, we're doing digital transmissions now. There's no more analog TV. And that's another thing, you know, when you think about, you know, extraterrestrial life, and they just touch on it in this, you know, if it exists and all this stuff, it's you know, we have been using radio for such a tiny, tiny amount of time, you know, comparatively, you know, just, you know, it's in decades. So who knows if radio is what we're going to be using in 50 years at all. I think the chances are pretty slim, you know, but there are still some things about radio that make it a good way to communicate. And there's a book called Confessions of an Alien Hunter. I think it's by a guy named Shostak.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he's a SETI guy. And he talks in that book about how they do things and what their thinking is on why they believe. You know, it's there actually is a whole lot of thinking that goes on into how, you know, if we wanted to communicate, how would we do it? And they're trying to listen in that same way. And there's reasons for it. It's not just because we can do radio. It's because radio is actually a good way to do it. But, you know, they're thinking of a lot of other things. There's another book out there called The Eerie Silence by Paul Davies. And I mentioned that just because the author of that is, he just needs to tell you that God doesn't exist every other page, it seems like.
Oh, great. That's
so,
what
it was so
somebody's
annoying. I got it on audio and I was so excited. And I started to listen to it and I was like, oh, you know, come on. That's not about that. Oh, come on. Anyway, after about an hour, I just said, I'm not going to listen to this anymore.
You know what? I got it. If you want to do this, could you write a book called There Is No God and then write another book about this with that
and that's
out of
it. You know, I have, you know, Carl Sagan was an atheist. You know, I, you know, it's just, I don't need you to tell me that every, you know, so often.
Well,
unless the book is about it, just like you're saying.
Well, that's okay. You can write a book about it because then if I want to know what you think about it, I'll pick it up.
For sure. And I think this is a, you know, if you look at this story, the whole story, you know, what was Carl Sagan trying to do? And I think that was a really incredible thing that he was trying to do. Because if you look at the atheists back then, you know, Carl Sagan was one that I admired, and a guy named Stephen Jay Gould is another one that I admired a great deal.
He was always a little gentler, I thought, than some of these.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, now we have Richard Dawkins, who, you know, the impression I have of Richard Dawkins is if I was walking down the street, he would be yelling at people as we walk by, you know.
He'd have the soapbox opposite to the crazy Christian.
Exactly. He's the same thing. But yet Carl Sagan, what he writes is not a book about how God doesn't exist and everyone who believes in it is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
What he writes is a novel in which he's trying to reconcile or make two sides of an argument understand each other so that they can get along better.
Which is really great.
It is really great. And Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book called Rock of Ages, in which I think that he was incorrect. I read the book. What he was saying is, you know, science and religion are incompatible. And he was saying what we have here are non-overlapping magisteria, is what he kept calling it.
Oh,
and
that's totally wrong.
Yeah, and exactly. So what he's saying is, you know, you want to compartmentalize science and you want to compartmentalize religion. And that's what his book was all about. And as an atheist, I can understand what he's saying. But as religious people, you know, science should not be in conflict. And we need to all be strong enough to know that if science contradicts religion, either the science is incorrect or the religion is incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this whole idea that something, you know, can't contradict truth.
Right.
Okay, and it's all one big thing. Okay, and,
right.
and people need to be strong enough about that. And so you have these churches that, you know, do the sola scriptura and things like that, that just, you know, it just doesn't
only
work.
The Bible.
The Old Testament is not a textbook about science.
Oh, heavens, no.
Yeah, so, and everything, you know, and it doesn't say in there that, you know, there's no equations and things in there. And it's all interpretation and...
Well,
you know,
that's
we all
like
get
saying,
tied up in these knots,
yeah,
but
that's like somebody from China trying to interpret, you know, Jane Austen's books,
yeah,
in their own culture without having the context of the English lifestyle.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you've got to have the proper context for what the people had in mind when they were writing, the points they were trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without question.
It was a book about faith. It wasn't a book about science. And they can express things about creation beautifully without having to worry about, I don't know the molecules that were used to create the horse, but I feel that God created the horse, like in the book of Job.
Right.
And I...
Yeah, yeah. And there are religious scientists all over the place. And
yeah.
And
the
scientific atheists seem to believe that a Christian... person who's a scientist, I don't want to say Christian scientist, but a Christian person who is a scientist would look at like doing some experiment and then they would reach a point and they would say, oh, well, God did the rest. That's not what Christian people who are scientists do. They are as interested in finding out how it works as atheist scientists.
And they're not trying to use science to prove God's there.
They're not.
Mendel.
That they see God in the workings has nothing to do with their scientific progress. They're doing experiments just the same as other scientists. And then that's why intelligent design, I don't know, it seems to me that it's that word has gotten hijacked because
I
think that it means more in certain circles than it means to me, because when I look at evolution and things like that, I can say, well, this is how things appear to have taken place, but God is behind it,
right?
You know, and that to me is what intelligent design is. It's no more than that. It's not like I'm saying, okay, evolutionary scientists, I need you to stop what you're doing now because obviously we don't need to know any more about that. And God just did the rest and you should just accept that. That's not what that word means.
It means
that there is an intelligence behind the creation of the universe. And,
well, that's the thing. And I'm trying to remember the book I read and I got just hammered over the intelligent design thing, but I'd never heard of that before really. And it's by... Oh, Lee Strobel, who wrote like The Case for Faith, The Case for Christ. And and I found those books interesting. And he wrote one like, I can't remember, The Case for a Creator or something. And that had sample interviews or interviews with all these different scientists across a variety of disciplines who he would talk to them about their science. And they then, and of course he was asking questions about it, would talk about how in doing their science, they could see glimpses of God. And I found it really inspirational and a kind of a good sampler of how what you're saying. And then people who, from both sides, just jumped all over me because the intelligent design thing, they're like, well, you're saying this and this and this. And I was like, well, that's not what I'm saying, but okay. So I quit using that term ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's too bad. It just doesn't. I don't know how it got hijacked. You know, it just seems to have popped up all of a sudden about, you know, what, 8 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago, and now everybody uses it.
Well, and that kind of almost leads into a thing I wanted to say about the movie, if I could just twist it for a second, because one of the phrases that kept getting repeated over and over and over from beginning to end was, if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space. And I thought, well, okay, that's a praiseworthy thing in terms of, let's go see what else is out there. But in terms of a Christian or Catholic, I guess specifically Catholic thing, that's not necessarily true. It could be true, but that's such a human way of defining it. Like, everything has to be created for that specific purpose. The universe has to be created that if there's all that space, there should be something useful in it.
Right.
Useful being life. And our definition wouldn't be the same as God's. And that was my only problem with that. I got it. I didn't even have a problem with them saying it, except for the fact of what I just said. And I was reading something in Magnificat, and this kind of goes back to people saying, well, you can't combine religion and science, and it all has to be specifically useful. And if you're going to prove God, you have to show where you entered in. And people try to do that, which is crazy. But Anthony, I don't know if he's Esolen, E-S-O-L-E-N. He's a well-known kind of intellectual sort of a writer, and he wrote this thing for Magnificat last month, which is, that's a little devotional book that you can, or magazine that you can get, and it's got the three sets of readings for the day from the church and all these things. But he said, behold the glint of the firefly in the twilight. Behold the Milky Way of a billion stars. Sorry, my voice is going. Each is as nothing to God, and each is great enough to hold him in the fullness of his glory. All the ancient universe was made so that the firefly could glow for his moment on earth. We believe that God loves us, but the weakness of our own love causes us to forget that he loves the quince bush in the yard, the dog on the lead, the mist in the air, the ray of light playing in a world so far from us that by the time we see it, it will have ceased to be. We are tempted to lose heart because we know that all creatures of time must pass away. But as time is filled with eternity, so all creatures are filled with God's being, especially those creatures whom he has made to respond to him in love. When we behold the beauty of a grain of dust, we give praise to God. It is a prayer of sweetness and peace, which we should do more than remember, for by it God fashions for us a dwelling place as small as a seed and as great as the heavens. Let us knock at that dwelling place and enter in.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Well, yeah, it just seemed to me almost to be a poetic way of saying the kinds of things that you were saying, is that it is all one thing. It's because it's what Matthew McConaughey's lamentable character kept saying, truth. Scientists and religious people, who may be one and the same, are all looking for what's true.
Right.
And that I did find to be a good characteristic of Jodie Foster's character in the congressional hearing toward the end, where they're going, and do you deny that it could have happened like this scenario, which is all fake? And she's like, well, okay, I can't say it wasn't all in my own head. And everyone, she's like, well, as a scientist, I have to say that, but I'm telling you, it wasn't.
Yeah, and that speech at the end was a home run, and as far as I'm concerned.
That I did like.
Yeah, that was
her delivery was good. The speech was great.
Heck yeah. So,
go ahead.
No, yeah, I wanted to make sure that I mentioned something big in Sagan's book. But yeah, the speech was fantastic. And the speech comes after, you know, contact is made. They have to build this machine, you know, what's downloaded.
Which was pretty cool looking.
Yeah, that was a cool thing. And then, you know, this billions of dollars, you know, billions and the billions of dollars. And then they, but it was fascinating, the whole thing. And I like the epic feel of it, how there was a scene where she arrives at Kennedy Space Center and drives through the crowd. And that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But the whole epicness of how this is affecting everybody. And there's still so much to talk about. But the you know, how do you select one person to represent humanity?
Well, that was interesting too.
Huge.
That
I
her
mean,
point
my
of
goodness.
Yeah, they communicated through science, so we should pick a scientist. And I'm like, but that was the only way there was to communicate.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And you know, I could certainly see someone believing that, but how on earth would that happen? You know, in the book, there was six people that went, I think. Five or six people. Yeah.
I thought it was weird that there was only room for one, but it worked with the idea of her being the main focus.
Yeah, one of the things that I really loved about how humanity was portrayed in this movie was the moment, you know, they get these instructions from an advanced alien race.
Mm-hmm.
And then all these engineers and stuff, they pore over it and they say, this thing needs a chair.
I did love that.
Was that something else? Because that totally would happen.
Yeah,
you're just
it's just like they didn't.
There's
going to
be some.
I think we shouldn't have a chair. And they're like,
guy,
we know what we're doing.
Yeah, some guy's going to go. Yeah, you know, this needs a chair. How can it not have a chair?
Well,
and
then,
it just shows how there's this rut. Just like you were talking about the rut about how everything needs to have the purpose. You know,
right.
But there's this thinking that humanity does, and it almost killed her.
She's shaking to death in that thing, and
right.
she gets out
yeah,
of it.
Even when she's, they're getting ready to launch, and she's like, okay, you're okay to go, she's shaking like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And if she just didn't have the chair, everything probably would have been fine.
Right. Luckily, she got a wonderful view of a cool galaxy, so she got out the window, or to look out the window or something, or no, she dropped her compass.
That's right, and the compass was floating, and it wasn't shaking, so she was like, I think I'm going to get out of this chair.
Oh, yeah. That's why? Because I just figured she wanted her compass back.
No. If she was shaking violently and the compass was totally steady.
Floating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that made sense because then right after that, it smashed into
the
ceiling.
And if she hadn't got out of the chair, she would have been doomed.
Yeah.
So
that was actually, just to break in for a second, that was one of the things I did love about the movie was this concept of getting in this little ball that just drops down into the middle of this thing. No launching, like we would think of it.
Yeah.
And then it just takes off on this wormhole, through this wormhole. And when it kind of paused for a minute, she's looking out the window going, wow, that's crazy. You know, it's something beautiful.
Yeah.
And then it takes off again. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like she's on this train that was a way station. And I just loved it. And I was looking forward each time to the different things she got to look out on as she was changing wormholes or whatever.
Yeah.
I did think that was pretty brilliantly alien to how we would usually think.
Yeah, fantastic. So then she arrives at some place, wherever that place is, and then some alien, who we never actually see, appears to her as her dad. And that did happen. That did happen in the book. In the book,
did
there
it?
Was five different people, and each of them were visited by someone else.
Someone significant.
Someone significant to him. Yeah, and for some reason, the explanation given is that this is just how it's done, and they needed to talk to.
That's
they needed
handy.
To communicate with you in this way at this stage, and that's all the explanation they offer. Yeah,
you can't handle the truth.
You bet.
No truth handler, you.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
They said, there's a whole bunch of us out here, and you're going to meet us someday, but now's not the time.
Well, I didn't actually have a problem with them taking on the form of her father.
Mm-hmm.
Except we kind of seen she had the daddy issue going on through the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
The thing when Matthew McConaughey says the same line and she goes, oh, really? Let's smooch again. If it's just us, it's like an awful waste of space. And she suddenly turns around and goes, I connect with you. And Rose is like, daddy issues. And I'm like, oh, and then they're in bed. And I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
But the thing that got me about the portrayal of the father in the movie was I didn't. That was fine. That was all good. And we put you on this beach because it looks like what you're used to. Okay, that's fine too. But the thing was, when every so often he'd act like he was her father, and then every so often he'd be this alien, and there was something really creepy in the way.
Yeah, it was. It was odd. And
it
was kind of the same in the book. It was almost, I don't know. Maybe the alien didn't quite understand.
Well, and that's maybe that was an alien thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's how alien they were. They didn't get that separation. Because I was like, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop hugging her.
Yeah. Now, this would be a spoiler of the book. So if you don't want the book spoiled, let me know. or fast forward or whatever. But the during that visit with the alien, One of the things that he tells her right when she's getting ready to go back is that the universe has been designed and they don't know who designed it. The aliens don't even know. And, the evidence is in pi. You know what pi is?
Oh, yeah, the number.
Circumference divided by diameter of a circle, mm-hmm. which is a physical constant in the universe, right? But it's an irrational number, which means, you know, circumference divided, it goes 3.14159, blah, 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 for a long, long time. When you get out to the 10 to the 20th digit, it turns into ones and zeros.
Oh, really?
And it's information, yeah.
Ooh.
And it's messages. And they haven't decoded the messages. Even the aliens, they don't know what it means.
That's so interesting. Because in the movie, they say
Jodie Foster, but Ellie Arroway says something like, "You'll let us know when you figure that message out."
Yeah, that's interesting. That makes me think of.
Oh, go ahead.
Dilbert Scott Adams, who does Dilbert cartoons, and on his blog, and I just kind of every so often will go and look at it, but he had said something one time about DNA and all the information that's packed into it. And almost like it's, you know, organized by somebody who knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That same kind of a thing of pi being, you know, communication.
Right. And another thing that was mentioned there is, you know, pi, the pi that we know is in base 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said, so if you were in some other base, let's say, you know, you had eight fingers and your numbers are based on the number 8. You would notice that something was going on there at 10 to the 20th power or 10 to the 20th digits out.
Oh, it would work
wrong. Yeah, but it wouldn't be ones and zeros. So the point was that only a 10-fingered, anyone who is base 10 would see the information.
So if you're a frog person,
you'd know something was wrong there because you'd see a pattern, but you'd have to figure out to change it to base 10 to see the messages.
Be a little bit smarter then.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's kind of like, you know, remember in 2001, I don't know if you've read the book or seen the movie, but
the
monolith was placed on the moon so that when the sun hit it, it sent a message to Jupiter. It was there because they said, okay, when humanity digs this up, we'll know that they're advanced far enough.
Yeah.
And that's what the message in the universe, it was a similar thing. When whoever intelligent life figures out how to bring this out to 10 to the 20th power, then they'll see the message.
They'll be advanced enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. And that's interesting that Carl Sagan would leave that in the, or put that in the book, which was the same thing about, you know, that they did maintain in the movie that, you know, who knows really, we all have our own interpretation of truth and what it is, but we can all, together, look for the truth.
And that is awesome. I mean, you know, compare that to the atheists that are running around today, you know, digging everything up. And, you know, it's just, it's very frustrating to me. You know, back then, Carl Sagan and again, Stephen Jay Gould, seemed like very good people. You know, they were atheists. They had a philosophy, but they weren't interested in being antagonistic. They didn't want to be antagonized against either, and that's certainly understandable.
Yeah, because really, what's the point? I mean, I don't know. I look at those really angry people, because there are really angry religious people, too. There are people who are angry at the Catholic Church or angry at, you know, some other religion. And you just go, you don't have daddy issues, but what other issues do you have that are making you feel like you have to have everybody agree with you and strike out in this way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like that's a personal deficit on their part.
Right.
Somehow.
I think so too. I mean, we all need to get along with each other.
Well, yeah, because it's, in fact, it's kind of like Tom was going to some Drupal meeting last night and he said, well, this is just a really, really basic seminar, but I can meet some people. And I said, you know, sometimes when I've gone to those really basic things, I've been surprised at some of the most elemental things that people will bring up that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he came back and said, I learned two or three things I never knew, and I thought I knew all about this level. And so if scientists and religious people, it's almost in that sense that the Contact movie was kind of that way, that conversation that Matthew McConaughey and Ellie have at the party.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that, look, here's a super basic concept, and she never thought of it. And it's right. one that I'd never thought of until I'd read about it,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, she's going, well, I have to have everything proved. And, you know, you wrote this book and you're wrong and about God and all this stuff. And he says, well, there are some things that can't be proven. She's like, nope, nope, impossible. And he goes, well, did you love your father? Yes. And we know that's true. And she goes, well, prove it. And she's like, wait.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people, my mother, who used to be one, would say, well, it's a series of electrical impulses going to your brain. And I'm like, okay, see, you're just really not playing fair.
Right.
Because yeah. you can't really believe that, or you wouldn't, you would admit it. I mean, love isn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Unless yeah. you haven't really experienced it. Then you're just, you know, hiding, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So go watch the movie.
No, don't.
I really liked it, of course.
Well, Scott will say watch the movie.
There's still so much more to say about science. You know, we'll, you know, in future books, we'll talk about more of it. But I really enjoyed this movie. I liked the epic feel to it. I really liked how it was a realistic portrayal of the possibility of alien contact. And it seems mm-hmm. to me more likely that there will be a message in some way, you know, assuming that an alien race is like us and that they want to know if they're alone or not. I would assume that someday this is more likely than Independence Day.
Well, we certainly hope so.
We certainly hope so. Independence well, Day was... or what's that recent one? District
9 was different, though.
Okay, District 7.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, is District 9 the animated one? Yeah, no, District 9. Okay,
District
9
the
one in South Africa.
African
yeah,
one.
I thought it was pretty cool.
Which was, because we were talking about it, and I was like, why is it, because they kept saying through this movie, and I was like, I'm not sure that's true. They kept saying, because we know if they're aliens, they're advanced past us. And I'm like, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah,
I think
and the thing is, you know, if there are thousands and thousands or millions, billions and billions of alien races out there, there's going to be some that are
like
not
us
as advanced,
or less than
and there's going to be some that are more
so
advanced.
Different. We can't. Well, and that's, I said, oh, I don't think there's been a movie like that. And we suddenly went, oh, yeah, District 9, those aliens were... Yeah. You know, just the worker aliens, which
and
is also
and that's,
a great
that's
movie.
A whole concept, too, that, you know, advanced. Why, how can we possibly believe that the way that we evolved as a society, you know, I mean, evolution as in civilization, is the only way that it's done? You know, we're going to discover electricity, and then we're going to discover this, and then we're going to discover that. You know, is there no other way? I think that that's closed-minded thinking, too.
But that's that thinking of this is all we know, and that's so...
Wouldn't it be fascinating to find an alien race who never discovered electricity, but yet is more advanced?
Hmm.
You know, how would they
do
stuff?
Well, that's one of the things that if it doesn't happen during our lifetime, and I don't count on it, that, you know, I'm just... when I go to heaven, okay, God, are there others? Let me see them. I want to see what they're like.
Yeah.
Oh, this is great, you know?
Super intelligent shades of the color blue.
Yeah.
Remember that Douglas Adams?
Yeah. Well, we were trying to think of other movies that there really isn't another movie that has this same sort of a message. And since it's me, I'm going to say, I'm sorry to say, but the two movies that we thought of, Rose, I haven't seen Solaris.
Hmm.
And she said the Russian version, I've heard this also, not the George Clooney one, and it's on my list to see sometime. She goes, that for kind of some of the father things and connecting with the scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of K-Pax for the friendly aliens investigating the Earth.
Interesting.
Theme, and kind of helping people see more about who they are. It's not the same, but it's an interesting take on that.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen.
I have. I've seen K-Pax. Yep.
Okay.
I haven't seen the Russian Solaris, but I'm interested in it.
Neither. Yeah. Yep. Me either.
Stanislaw Lem.
I know.
Yeah.
I think I tried reading one of his books a long time ago. Russian science fiction is pretty hardcore and crazy, and I don't think I got very far.
Yeah.
Have you read these
stuff? I read a short story about robots. I'm trying to remember details, but yeah, that's all I've read. And I have a book called The Siberiad, which was recommended to me, but I haven't read it yet.
Is that by him?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Stanislaw Lem, and it's a collection of stories that are connected somehow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Kind of like that Small World
read.
Yep. Which has nothing in common with this. It is in outer space, and it does use scientific themes. It's by Dominic Green, I think. But it's a series of short stories, some of them long short stories, that all kind of connect together, and then you kind of see how this world is. So.
You bet.
I was trying to think, the statement that she makes at the hearing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I thought was completely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I was looking for the verbiage, but I didn't get very far in looking. But somehow they managed to make it so that what she does is she says, we are so insignificant and so puny.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, it is so humbling.
We're all precious, yeah.
And so, to see that because of that, life is precious and we are precious, and anybody we connect to, and she's thinking of the alien race, but of course I apply it to people, and nature and everything, anything that we connect to helps us become more than what we are. And we need that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really well done, I thought, in terms of being a statement of kind of what a religious moment of epiphany can do for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That wasn't stated in any religious lines at all. It was very interesting. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
That may have been what Carl Sagan was doing in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by it nurtures understanding between, that's one of the powers of fiction, and probably why he wrote a novel instead of a nonfiction book in this case.
Yeah.
Is because, if he can make you feel that, and this person did that in a completely scientific way, and a scientific person can watch that and understand what she's feeling right then, then that brings them closer to understanding what a religious person feels.
Yeah, because she never does do anything like, and so then there must be a God.
Yeah,
what that does is it helps her understand Matthew McConaughey's point, the priest's point, the ex-priest or the religious guy.
Yeah, the never has been priest.
Well, and it was good that they had him, because I have to say that was, for however much we fault it, it was at least a positive portrayal of a forward-thinking religious person, not along sociological lines, but just along lines of science isn't opposite to religion, because they also showed the religious fanatic. And I just looked at that guy and went, I was like, who is that? He looks so familiar. And Tom was like, I'd say it's Gary Busey, but he's too young. And then we went, oh, later, Jake Busey.
Jake Busey, wow. Yeah,
he passed that face right on, poor guy.
Right.
But he did a great job of being the hard-eyed, focused, religious fanatic who's, I'm going to die rather than let you go to outer space.
Yep, exactly.
So you had those people too, and all the nuts that get attracted. And that was very similar to a scene in Mars Attack.
Well, I remember how happy I was, when after that explosion that this religious guy pulls off, and then Haddon calls her on the satellite phone and says, "Want to take a ride?" I thought that was kick butt. I was just like, and it's funny. I mean, there's so many disciplines in here that I can. That's probably why one of the reasons why I like it so much is that I understand so much about it. I'm involved in those kinds of projects. I've worked for the government, and what he says about, hey, why build one when you can have two, that totally possible, completely. And and the Japanese version is probably put together better too.
Doubtless. I know, we're like, oh, this is the one to be on, really. Said that. We're like,
for sure, the doors close with just the right.
get to Japan. Well, yeah, with the right level of tolerance.
Exactly.
And that that does bring up the thing too that we kind of discussed a little bit, which is that her video camera's on, but they can't hear anything, see anything but static, which I thought was very clever. The whole time, but. And so they're doubting her, and she's being hammered on by this hearing, which the guy's made pretty clear he's doing for electoral reasons. And then when Angela Bassett, one of the people I liked in it, is she's like an advisor to the president or a secretary of superior standing or something, and she tells the guy, she goes, well, yeah, it was just static. And he, did you read the report? And he's like, yeah, I flipped through it. She's like, well, here's the thing. It was 18 hours of static because there's a huge controversy because on Earth it looks like it just dropped through, disappeared for a second, came back. And the wormholes did it all in one night. Like a Christmas carol.
You bet.
she was gone all that time and it really, really happened. But she didn't know that and she may never know it, but she believed it because it happened on faith.
Right, right.
I didn't feel like they needed that proof.
Yeah, and that's interesting too. It's curious that you know we're talking about the ending of Inception and whether or not that ending was needed, and then here we are again. You know, it's almost as if in this case, not in the Inception case, but in this case, it's almost as if the director, in my opinion, was worried that the audience would think that it was ambiguous. So he wanted to make sure that they knew that it was real. And he didn't want anybody saying, oh, well, she probably didn't even happen to her.
Well, it's funny because after leaving everything else open so that you could think about it, that they closed shut.
That they closed shut. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
It is an interesting choice. But I that's the only reason I can think of that why putting that
we
in.
We just went, huh, well, that's cool. That's fun to hear. But it was unnecessary. So. Yeah.
And I think it was too.
Hannah wanted me to make sure to put one point in, which is always her pet peeve in talking to scientists who are atheists or scientific students in her case, which is that you can't posit an unprovable hypothesis. So when they say you can't prove that God exists, so there's no God, she's like, well, they can't prove he doesn't exist. So they can't go around saying it so absolutely.
Yeah, you can't prove a negative.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, she said, be sure to say this. And I went, okay, I will say it.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
I think she runs into more people like that than I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in college, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that going around. You know, heck, I was one of them.
Well, and she's still hanging out with a lot of friends and a lot of people, of course, of that age, early 20s. And they get into these things because they'll, oh, you're Catholic. And she's like, oh, here we go. So,
and again, you know, this is, you know, like I say, I was one of them. And, you know, I was never one to run around and debate all the time. I just believed what I believed. And if someone talked to me about it, I would talk to them about it. But I wasn't running around looking for people to talk to about it. But well, a movie like this, like I said, you know, brought me closer. It's not something that's going to convert somebody.
Right.
But it is something I think... There's a lot of value in making things seem reasonable, meaning, you know, we're told, you know, a lot of atheists are told by other atheists that it's just, you know, it's doesn't make any sense. And, you know, how could you believe this? This is myth. And, you know, why don't you believe in a pink unicorn type of stuff?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, John C. Wright, I don't know if you look at his blog, he was just going through that with somebody.
Oh, okay.
Like, oh, you write science fiction, but yet you believe in this mysterious being
and
that impregnated a virgin. And
boy, you know, we get that a lot. And then, you know, you can come away from this movie thinking, okay, well, I'm closer to understanding what's going on here and why it's not a pink unicorn. You know what I'm saying? It to me, that this movie has a lot of value in that. It certainly had that value for me personally, where... I was able to take a step closer because of this movie. And that's why it was important to me.
And maybe that was part of our well, no, I'm sorry. I can't even say that. Mm-hmm. No, I have to hang on to my hated it, but as a movie. But all of us already had that. But, you know, It had a 68% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so we know we're in the minority on not liking the movie. But we all kind of knew where we stood because we thought it through or talked about it enough, and maybe that's part of it. We didn't need to see that.
Yeah, it's possible that that's part of it. You know,
we didn't need
there was some things said in this movie that were the first time, you know, like Ellie, you said it's the first time she'd ever heard that. Well, I think this was the first time I'd ever heard that too. And and that's something, you know, again, has value. So you would look at that and you go, well, maybe that's something I need to think about.
Yeah. Well, and I was like you, in fact, into my 40s, I guess, in terms of, I didn't believe in God, but I didn't go around beating people up. Or I actually was more, it wasn't that I didn't believe, I didn't know what to believe. I went back and forth between going, how could people believe that? And, well, maybe he's out there. How would I know? Mm-hmm. You know, I was really that thing that people always say there isn't, which is a true agnostic. I was really curious. But I would just think about it every so often. And on the terms of likelihood, it didn't seem very likely to me. Hard to prove it.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So I wasn't going around like you. I knew what I thought, and I wasn't going to go around and argue about stuff. But it kind of takes me back to that priest when she was little and that lost opportunity, because I was just thinking about one of the things that kind of helped open my mind to the fact that things might not work the way I thought they did actually came in, was it biology class in the eighth grade, when for some reason our teacher had us, maybe it was a debate class, but I don't think I ever took debate. I think it was a science class. He had us debating, is there a God based on the Bible? And he said, and it would be really good if you take the position opposite to what you believe. And I went, okay, I'll take the position of proving there's a God then. And another person I knew took, she must have been Christian, she tried to prove there wasn't a God. And the thing that got me was somewhere in looking stuff up, I read that, you know, God doesn't define time the way we do. So a minute to God could be thousands and thousands of years, or a day, you know, that 7 days thing.
Sure,
6 days.
Sure. Yeah.
Could be all this time. And that's the first time I had ever encountered that. And that was what I based my entire argument on, was God doesn't define things the way humans do. This is just how they interpreted it so they'd understand. And I still think back to that. And when I watched this movie and some of the suppositions that people had made, like Ellie specifically, and when we were talking, I kind of flashed back to that. It was a really powerful moment because both of us proved our cases so well that the class couldn't decide who won. And just having to look into and honestly try to argue for the side I didn't believe in helped me understand the way they thought. It didn't convert me, but it was one of those building blocks. And so that priest, and just kind of turning around and going, well, I can't do anything with this. I don't know what to say.
Lost opportunity.
Lost
no
that
doubt.
Moment to plant that seed, you know?
Yeah, and that's a good thing to know too, you know?
Yeah, kind of.
So
that
those
being,
things happen, you know, in your life. Yeah. And yeah, if he, you're right. If he had offered something else, even though she wouldn't accept it then, maybe later she would have.
Yeah, it would have built. And that's kind of the, kind of what you see in terms of her little side relationship. I think it's supposed to be more, but it turned out to be a side relationship with Matthew McConaughey or Palmer, whatever his name is that he's continually planting these seeds and then they won't see each other for a really long time.
Yep.
And it kind of all culminates in the end where she's like, I understand what you're saying. You know?
Yep. So. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I still say go watch the movie.
Yeah, I still say I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. You know, but at least we can disagree cheerfully.
That's for sure. You bet. All right. So next up in a couple of weeks, we've got Declare by Tim Powers.
Yes.
And I haven't started it yet, but you have?
I have. I'm about halfway through. It's a surprisingly large book. I know you didn't know that when you chose it. I'm not going to call you, what was it?
Victor von Longenstein.
Oh, goodness. But it's kind of interesting because it's the kind of espionage style that I don't usually enjoy. So reading it for this kind of made me push past going,
mm-hmm.
until I got into the book. So I'm really liking it.
Oh, great. That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, I'm at the halfway point. I just
fantastic.
Got ready to start book two last night.
Oh, fantastic. Good deal.
Yeah.
Okay, and then after that, we get October.
Yes, and we'll have Shaun of the Dead
mm-hmm.
and Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Fantastic.
Ray Bradbury.
All right. And then a couple of my picks. I picked The Social Network.
Yeah.
And I picked that with a little hesitation because I it's not really a Catholic movie, but there's a lot of things that I would really like to talk about, and that's why I picked it.
Yeah, Catholic movie, mm-hmm. you know. I don't care about that.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, we're not selecting Catholic movies here, but
right.
but for the podcast, there's a lot of subject matter that to cover on that one, and that's
people
why
connecting
I
to people.
It's not because I think it's the best movie ever.
oh, it's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
It is
yeah.
what it is. I
right.
you know, it's not a movie I care to see like a zillion times.
Sure,
but it's a
yeah.
good movie. It's mm-hmm. well done.
Yeah,
it's like Quiz Show.
Quiz Show, yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then in November, Way Station by Clifford Simak.
Which I
few
love.
A few more aliens.
Yeah, I love that.
Great. Book. That's great.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And then we're into December after that.
I know. And I think I can't remember if I've said I've had these. If I got December, I already knew for a long time what I was going to do. But I'm not going to say yet because we've got so many books lined up already.
Yeah. Yeah. We're
going to leave some suspense.
Ooh, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening.
Yes. Yes. Don't go see that movie. But, you can have last words and you can stay to go see it.
Oh, yeah. You go see the movie.
No, I'm going to see it. Have a great couple of weeks,
all
everyone.
Right. You too. We'll see it.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.